All right, you know, I'm sure we've all had times we had to rob Peter to pay Paul. And by that, I mean, I'm sure that most folks listening to this have had those days where paying one bill meant not paying another. Or for that matter, maybe you've had times when some very important bills got paid on a credit card. I mean, it can be extremely frustrating, and if you're not careful, it can get away from you in a hurry. To this day, I'm really not sure how my family made it through my late in life decision to go to law school. I mean, there I was in my early 30s with a wife, two kids, a dog, and a mortgage, and now I go to law school? But with careful application of a second mortgage on the house, a little bit of GI Bill, two very modest day job paychecks, and a credit card, the shell game played out for 3 years. Using the credit card to pay for daily trips to Birmingham for class, pay down the balance as best we could, draw from the credit line to pay tuition when the GI Bill was short, pay it back down, then draw it again when the regular paycheck got irregular, which was all too often. It was like 3 years of financial tightrope walking. But God was faithful. I graduated, and somehow the light stayed on, and the kids always had Christmas. My lovely wife, Charlene, though, she was the miracle worker. She literally used to sit down every month and plan out every dinner for the next month. For 30 days, she would plan out the dinners, every last one. And then she would take stock of what we had in the cupboard for the ingredients, and she'd make a shopping list for all the rest. I remember once I was in a group of friends, somebody was complaining about the cost of groceries, and I told them how Charlene handled our groceries, and they were impressed. But their appreciation turned to shock when I told them that she fed the whole family of four and the dog for about $2.50 a month. One lady said, "My word, I spend that every week." I mean, truthfully, there weren't many vacations, but the kids always had new clothes for school. And truthfully, again, we didn't really lack for anything. In my recollection, there was still a lot of laughter in the house. And we have said many times that we don't take it for granted, not by a stretch. So yes, Charlene and I learned firsthand what it means to live within our means. Do we have some debt? Sure, still paying the mortgage on this beautiful house. But generally speaking, we're doing what many of you are doing. We're trying to responsibly live within our means. Can't quite say the same though for government. Nope, state and federal. Spending is like a full contact sport in government. Writing checks as fast as possible. Feeding the beast of fiscal irresponsibility. Too often with the government, it becomes more about the Benjamins, less about the people. So let's take them one at a time here. The federal government is unique because apparently the federal government is allowed to operate in a spending deficit at every turn. Deficit spending. It's a term that every American should know firsthand. It is literally defined as government spending in excess of revenue of funds raised by borrowing rather than from taxation. Yeah, the bottom line is that where Charlene and I threaded the financial needle to get through law school with the understanding that every dime of debt incurred would have to be repaid one day, Congress does not feel that way. Congress does not feel the same pinch. Deficit spending to Congress is illusory. It presents to the world the false notion that you've got it when you don't. It's spending more than you got, but somehow in the halls of Congress, that's allowable again and again and again. Every year, the United States government collects revenue from taxes and spends it on public programs and agencies. If at any given year it spends more than it earns, its yearly budget will result in a deficit. And to cover the deficit, the U.S. Treasury has to borrow money by selling securities like, you know, Treasury bills and notes and bonds and savings bonds to the public. And just like an individual who spends more than what he earns, though, will have to borrow the missing amount from a credit card. Well, the accumulated deficits year after year, they form an outstanding U.S. national debt. But hey, you know, spend it like you got it. But it's not always the Democrats, too. You know me, I'm a Democrat. I'll just right now, I'll chase that rabbit and say, I'm a longtime Republican. I am. I have never been a Democrat in my entire life. I have been elected Republican. I have been a Republican executive party member. I've been a Republican county chair. But I got to say, when it comes to spending, it's not always about the Democrats. My own party's bad at it. I mean, sure, the Dems love to spend somebody else's money. It's their superpower if you get down to it. But Republicans are perhaps more notorious because they call themselves the more conservative party. Yeah. This past December, a Republican House put together a spending extravaganza that came at a time when the national debt sat roughly at $36 trillion. Conservatives were immediately angry. The so-called budget process is absolutely broken in D.C. In my home state of Alabama, where I'm sitting right now, our state constitution requires that we form and pass a balanced budget. But in D.C., they have no such requirement. But what they do have is an open process called appropriations, in which each department is supposed to send in its requests. They get hammered out, debated in the so-called regular order business. Requires that each subcommittee, like transportation or public health or all the rest, send in their budgets to be compiled into one large budget. Well, the last time that happened was in the final year of Trump's first term. Instead, now, far too often, all they do is raise the debt ceiling, which is like getting more credit limit on your credit card. And then they pass another continuing resolution, which is just like saying, we will continue to do that which was already done. Except that they load up the continuing resolution with new spending and regulations. So is it really a continuance? Not really. You and I couldn't run our house like this. Because let's be clear, if you and I borrow money to do the things that we know and we assume the risk, what we're seeing in D.C. is more like what would happen if somebody took your credit card, ran up the bill, and then walked away from it. You didn't ask for all the debt, but you get to pay for it. Well, it got me to thinking, has there ever been a government leader in modern U.S. history who worked to reduce our public debt in a meaningful way? And you may be interested to know that there was, and it was President Calvin Coolidge, believe it or not. I read a biography on Coolidge recently. I came to an appreciation for the man. I mean, let me describe something for you, and I'll give full credit here. This comes directly from his bio from the Coolidge Foundation. I'm going to quote it directly. It says in part, Coolidge was elected Vice President of the United States in 1920. Coolidge succeeded to the presidency upon the sudden death of President Warren G. Harding in August 1923. Coolidge restored trust and credibility to the office of the presidency, and in 1924, he was elected president in his own right. And under Coolidge, it says, the federal budget was balanced and the national debt was reduced, and when Coolidge left office in 1929, the federal budget was actually lower than when he arrived at the White House 67 months before. Coolidge is quoted as having said personally, he said, I'm for economy, and after that, I'm for more economy. Look, the nation fared so well under Coolidge that people began talking what they called Coolidge prosperity. The Coolidge decade saw great technological advances, including things like transatlantic flight of Charles Lindbergh. This was the decade when Americans' homes were first electrified, the decade when the automobile became widespread. President Coolidge, he actually left office wildly popular. He famously chose not to run for re-election in 1928, believing that, quote, the chances of having wise and faithful public service are increased by having a change in the presidential office after a moderate length of time, he said. How about that? A president who cut spending, grew the measure of prosperity for the nation as a whole, and then left the office and the budget better than when he found it. Isn't that refreshing? So basically, it's possible. Not necessarily easy, but certainly possible for a visionary leader to address fiscal policy effectively. Yeah, Calvin Coolidge, he may have lived in a different time. He certainly didn't take office with all the debt that modern Americans currently have on hand. But his principles and his adherence to those principles, they're timeless. And they're lacking right now. They are lacking right now sorely as Congress just continues to spend it like they got it. Well, enter the Trump administration. Now, Trump has certainly asked for a slight increase in the current debt ceiling. I'm not happy about it, but I get it. Because the issue at hand right now is we need to get through this first fiscal year, the part that was started before he got here. Get the major points of the Trump agenda passed and do so without the Democrats having the leverage against us for another patchwork continuing resolution. The only way to do that without having Democrats defect and join us, which ain't going to happen, is to have some cash flow. Short term. And then in the meantime, DOGE identifies massive savings, cuts, downsizes, and by third quarter of the fiscal year, we can get to regular order of business, pass an actual budget, and it contains then the expected savings from DOGE and all the other actions. Okay, I like that. And there are a few chief executives, by the way, in modern history that I believe would have the political will to actually get that done. But I believe Trump will. And the polls indicate the vast majority of Americans also trust him to do it. Okay, so that's federal. That's just half our political lives, because people often forget the various state governments around the nation. They have their own levels of fiscal responsibility they have to adhere to. And each state has its own budget, its own spending, its own requirements. And sometimes They lose their way as surely as they do in D.C. For example, where I'm sitting right now, the Alabama State Senate just set a new record for a proposed spending. That's right, a record $12 billion education budget. That's huge, y'all. That is big. That's light years away from where we were when I was elected back in 2010 to the State Senate. $10 billion of that is fixed. The rest comes in the form of supplemental appropriations. But wow. And if you're not familiar, by the way, the education budget in Alabama is funded mostly by sales tax and income taxes. That's the education budget I'm talking about. Alabama is unique in all the world. We're one of the few states that has split budgeting. One budget is called the ETF, the Education Trust Fund. The other is the General Fund, which is basically everything except education. It's a product of the teachers' union influence that still carries over from the past. Well, the education budget actually gains when people are working and spending. And it would appear from the size of the budget they just passed that Senate Republicans in Montgomery, our state capital, believe that people are working and spending at a pretty good pace and that they have a budget surplus at their disposal to appropriate. Is that good news? Maybe. But consider this. 2 years ago, the legislature passed a great tax cut. No state income tax for overtime pay. It's a great plan. And man, has it worked. Folks are working more overtime than ever. Businesses are getting more employees in. It's growth and has exceeded all forecasts. They meant to basically expect $34 million-ish in refunds to the state or basically tax abatements. Yeah, it came to $300 million. That means it's working, right? More people are working. There's more revenues that are being set aside for people to have a tax break. But hey, that's just a good thing, isn't it? But now they're doing away with it. What? You heard me. They gave back too much money, apparently. So now they're going to let the tax break go so they can spend more. And by the way, they're doing that at a time when they have surplus budgets. Surplus. So you have a surplus, but you're doing away with tax relief. Well, listen, when you have surplus budgets in government, you know what that means? That means they have too much of your money. And then when you couple it with non-tax relief, that means they don't want to give it all back. Yeah, you hear about the amount of money in government, but then sometimes you get a glimpse of it and it can be both astounding and appalling. And in the midst of good times, fat times, one of the best and worst terms you can hear in regard to government is the words budget surplus. On the one hand, you would much rather know that those in charge of your government, well, they engage the appropriations, the spending, the revenue collection aspects of their jobs in such a way that the government's not ending up in a budget shortfall. That's bad. Never a good thing to find out that government did not collect enough of your money, and now it's cutting essential services. By the way, let me chase that rabbit. Notice I didn't say cutting government labor force, because that rarely happens. They cut services. You know, things that you and I need. Budget shortfall bad. Budget shortfall means lean times are upon us in some way, but then there's the other original term that I named, budget surplus. Budget surplus. It can mean that there's evidence that an economy is thriving, that revenues are up, except that you have to consider that budget processes are first and foremost based upon projections, which means they are planning their budgets well in advance of the money coming in. So that would mean they should have foreseen the amount of revenue and they should have budgeted accordingly. And yet still they wound up with more than they needed. But even the most expert opinions can go awry, I get that, sometimes in the positive direction, and suddenly, voila, extra money. Budget surplus, that's awesome. All right, but is it possible for a budget surplus to be a bad thing? And the short answer to that is yes. Basically, if the government has more money than it needed to operate, it means, in essence, they took too much from the taxpayers to begin with. And when you combine the government surplus with a lean economy and inflation, well, at that point, government begins to look a bit heartless. We're paying more at the store, we're paying more to the government, we're keeping less in our pockets, we're taking fewer vacations, while government winds up having more to spend. That's when budget surplus becomes a bad thing, when it's all about the Benjamins and less about the taxpayer. Like, I remember distinctly when I was in the Pentagon, I remember coming to the close of a fiscal year, word came down from the comptroller, hey, year end on us, we got to use it or lose it, please submit your capital expenses ASAP for approval and get those acquisitions in the hopper by the right date. Use it or lose it. What an awful, asinine concept. It basically means that the powers that be are going to be going for the next year's allocation, the big appropriation in the coming budget. But if you wind up with money left over, well, they might hold that against you and they might not give you the same amount. Or God forbid, they might give you less. Meanwhile, the average citizen runs their household, their private businesses, just the opposite. Like in the private world, if you have funds left over at the end of the year, that equals success. You can issue a shareholder dividend. You can take a trip to Disney World. Or here's a novel idea. You can put it in savings for lean times in the future. Well, during my time serving in the Alabama State Senate, I chaired the Senate Committee on Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Development. At one point, a research committee was formed, of which I was a part because of my chairmanship, and it was designed to review government spending and various processes related to budgets. I had recently discovered something that just chapped me, man, just wore me out. So I asked if I could use my time on that special committee to do some research on Alabama government departments and their budgeting. So I did. My secretary began putting together a notebook that just grew and grew and grew. We nicknamed the notebook Big Bertha. We left it out of my office at the credenza for anyone to come in and review who wanted to do so. You see, I had discovered quite accidentally that one department that handled State of Alabama's telecommunications was actually billing other departments to handle all of their departmental IT. So one government department was billing the other government departments. I thought the taxpayers already paid that bill. So yeah, the telecommunications department, I learned, whose services were not that great, by the way, made a good bit of extra money every year. I got a copy of their records. I was shocked to learn that they had a rollover account in which they carried their extra money from one year to the next. Basically, this IT department that billed all the other departments for their work also appropriated funds through the budget processes run by the legislature, and then they billed the other departments while on the taxpayer dime, and the other departments just factored that into their budget. They could care less. But the telecommunications department was not breaking even. Oh no, they were profiting. They had a running budget surplus in the tens of millions of dollars, but yet they kept bellying up to the budget trough to get their next tranche of taxpayer funds. And the self-licking ice cream cone just perpetuated itself. So I decided to find out how many other departments had funds left over in rollover accounts. And there were a lot of them. Sitting on their budget surpluses, still asking for more. So I made them all come in for a public hearing and show cause as to why they should be allowed to continue that practice. Some of them got mad, some were embarrassed, others were just indifferent to it. But we were able to shut down some of it. Now listen, I'm talking about spending right now, and I'm talking about government spending in particular, but I'm not so libertarian in my views that I don't believe that government does have a role. It does. It certainly does. I mean, essential services like infrastructure, law enforcement, defense, the court system, and a whole lot more, they all have a definite place, and I know that those things cost money. And they cost money, and government has to pay for it. I'm also not the one who believes that politicians ought to work for free. You get what you pay for, right? Most folks don't want to go bankrupt in public service, nor should they. But right now in my state of Alabama, we're sitting on a massive budget surplus unlike anything we've ever experienced in the history of our state. But they are the less seemly kind of surpluses. They're the kind that comes from having received too much revenue during hard times. The goal should be to point, you know, less into the idea of Benjamins and more into the idea of citizens. In other words, if it's a lean economy and you made a government surplus, that means you took too much from people who needed it more. Keep in mind that more money may seem better than less money, but more money taken from private citizens to fund government action, way in excess of what is needed, should never result in that rollover account or that year-end profit. Government should never be in the business of making a profit on the back of the taxpayers. There should also never be a use-it-or-lose-it spending spree. Budget surplus ought to be mandated to result in some form of revenue-sharing tax refund to the citizens of the state. And by the way, I don't mean a simple one-time token payment to appease the masses. I mean reform. I mean stop taking so much in the first place. And here's the thing. That tax refund I told you about earlier on the overtime tax, they're looking at letting that expire in Alabama. And I look at that and think, you have made it okay for people to keep more of their money. And then the lean economy They got to keep more money to feed their families. And you're not just going to consider whether to extend it. What you're really doing is taking it away. You've got a budget surplus, and yet you are not going to extend a tax cut. That's heartless. Look, maybe, just maybe, we'll see something one day that tells us that government, state and federal, cares more about the people, less about the Benjamins. And let me tell you, those are some big bad Benjamins I'm talking about. But the bottom line is this. Government's got to get back to handling revenue and expenses more like businesses do. Government should not profit. Government should also not throw us into a debt spiral. There's a happy medium at both the state and federal levels. Because the reality is this. If you are making money on the backs of the taxpayers, you're not an elected official, you're an elected bureaucrat at that point. So, more about the people, please. Less about the Benjamins. That's my philosophy.